So we will continue from where we were. Last time we talked about the four Brahmaviharas, or the four immeasurables, and how to meditate on those when you choose those to be your object upon which to develop serenity in the dhyanas. Okay, so there's many different objects you can use. That's one of them. I went into a lot of depth on that because I think that, well, a lot, you know, more depth, because, you know, I think those four topics, I mean, first of all, if we want to develop bodhicitta, they're requisite for bodhicitta. And second of all, you know, we're living in community and things always come up between people. And, you know, if we gain some proficiency in the four immeasurables, fewer things are going to come up. We're not going to get wigged out so much by what people do. So I think it's meditation that's helpful now. It creates good karma for future lives. It helps us, progress towards bodhicitta. And there we go. Yeah. So, you know, when we think about practicing the Dharma and becoming a Buddha, there's certain things about us that may not change. You know, your sense of humor may be the same, or, you know, some of your mannerisms and things like that. But there's some attitudes and emotional states we have that better change, because you know, you never hear of an angry Buddha who wants to retaliate for the harm that we've done them. Okay, so we definitely have to do something with, our hurt feelings, and not just sit there and either feel sorry for ourselves or plan revenge. You know, we have to, be able to look at those things and accept them. And this is where I think the immeasurable of equanimity can be helpful. Even we're not using it as our meditation object for developing serenity. You know, there's many types of equanimity, but one kind of equanimity is just the ability to accept things. Yeah, because when we don't accept things, then our mind is all ruffled up. You know, we don't like something. I don't like this. I want it to be that way. I don't like that. It should be this way. And we know that mind very well. Yeah, and so I'm going to sit there and, you know, tell people how they should change, and I'm going to do things to them to get them to change. But that's because I'm rejecting the reality of who somebody is, or the reality of the relationship. You know, and, you know, we can see this so often in our life. I mean, impermanence is, you know, we live in the sea of impermanence. We are impermanent. But so often we reject impermanence. You know, that person cannot die. Why did they die? Some people even get mad at the person who died because, you know, they're dependent on them. They don't want them to die. Yeah. It's just the way people handle grief. But it, you know, it depends on, you know, rejecting impermanence. And, you know, another wise quotation from my mom, you know, if you quarrel with what is, she didn't say this part, I'm adding to it. But, I mean, the part she said is, don't bang your head against the wall. Okay, why not? Because the wall is going to win, you know. And when we're sitting there, you know, saying, no, it can't be like this. It's got to change. I can't stand that person. They've got to change. This situation has got to change. Ah! I mean, how much time do we spend in that mental state? Yeah. When will these people ever learn, you know, whatever it is that we want them to learn? Yeah. Well, who knows? We don't know. But when we say, when will they ever learn, we're not looking for an answer. Yeah. What we're really saying is, I want them to change. Yeah. Well, yeah, we want a lot of things to change, and we're knocking our head against the wall about many of them. So equanimity does not mean indifference. Okay, repeat. Equanimity does not mean indifference. It's like, oh, you know, somebody lives, somebody dies. I don't care. I'm just equanimous about that. No. No, we don't want people to die unnecessarily. You know, there's enough death in the world. We don't want, you know, different things to go on to hasten it. But, you know, this is the way things are. And if we can just say, yes, this is the way things are. Yeah. And I wish it were different, but I don't have any power to change it. So rather than get all upset about it and point fingers at other people and want to retaliate and get mad, you know, then to say, okay, it happened this way, I accept it. I cannot control this world as much as I think I should be able to. Yeah? And then just that accepting it, you know, this is the way it is. Yeah. That doesn't mean we don't try and change it. Okay, we know what's happening in Minneapolis. It's not, well, yeah, I just accept the way ICE and the Border Control are acting, you know, that beating up people and barging into people's homes. I don't mind. No, it's not that attitude. Is like, you know how I would like it, but I don't have the power to change it. Yeah? And so, you know, to be equanimous, you know, instead of all revved up about things that I can't control. You know, if something happens in the future and I can have more power in this situation, yes, that's good. Work for the benefit of others. But if I can't, yeah, you getting what I'm saying? So this goes, you know, for the state of the country, and it also goes in terms of, you know, who does the chores and who doesn't do their chores. Yeah? You know, you could sit there and, you know, these people are not doing their chores. They need to do their chores. I can't stand this dirt on the floor. Well, you know, and then it's like, I know whose chore that is and they're not doing it. That person doesn't do anything around here. They're just a lazy bum. Yeah, then what are you going to do? Yeah, I'm going to talk to them. Well, somebody already talked to them. And it hasn't changed much. Well, I'm going to do something more drastic, like, give me an idea.
In the room, out on the lawn.
Oh, yes. Yes, I'll throw everything in the room out on the lawn. And then for sure, they will change after that. Yeah. I think I'll probably have to change after that, too. Yeah. I did throw somebody's stuff out on the lawn, but not everything in their room. Just some stuff that they left in the bathroom, piled high. Yeah, and he didn't do it after that. Yeah. So, yeah. But, yeah, just it's like, okay, do what we can and accept what we can't change. Okay. So we are on page 270, just following the reflection. Did you meditate on it? Yes? Okay, was it helpful? I hope so. Are you going to do it again? You promise? Oh, some people are going yes, and some people... Okay. So today we're going to go into more about the absorption factors and what is going on in the four dhyanas and how you progress from one to the next. Okay? So we should do our opening chanting and setting our motivation first. So think a little bit about what was said in the introduction and generate your motivation. Okay, so from we'll start page 270. By cultivating the five absorption factors, you remember those? Try. First one?
Investigation.
What?
Investigation.
Analysis.
Joy.
Bliss.
One-pointedness.
And one-pointedness. Okay. So by cultivating the five absorption factors, a meditator successfully suppresses the five hindrances and attains the first dhyana. Those five absorption factors were discussed in the Sanskrit tradition as well. So to review, first one, investigation, directs and applies the mind to the meditation object. So you have to know what your object is, otherwise... how are you going to put your mind on it? Uplifting the mind and placing it on the object, investigation brings the mind onto the object. It helps you get there. Okay. Second one, analysis, sustains awareness on the meditation object until the mind gradually becomes peaceful. For example, if the meditation object is the breath, analysis sustains attention on the breath, examining and knowing each breath very clearly. Okay. Or if your meditation object is the image of the Buddha, yeah, then investigation goes over the basic details and puts your mind there. Analysis goes and looks at it more closely and really develops an affinity with the object. Yeah, because I was thinking about it. You really have to be interested in what your object of meditation is. You know, if it's something that doesn't interest you, then it's going to be hard to keep your mind on it. Yeah. So sometimes you have to make your mind interested in certain things. For example, if you're doing Lamrim meditation, which is different than serenity meditation. But, you know, there may be certain topics that you feel a little bit stuck on. Yeah. And, but then you have to kind of work at it. Well, what actually is my doubt here? And, you know, yeah, what's going on? And, you know, make it interesting for yourself. Yeah. Okay. So investigation is compared to ringing a bell, and analysis is like the resonance of the sound. So investigation, you hear it. Analysis keeps you hearing it. Yeah. Other analogies are investigation is like a bird flapping its wings, and analysis resembles it floating. So less energy with analysis. Investigation is like holding a dish, and analysis is like drying it. Yes, you're doing what needs to be done. Okay, then the third factor, absorption factor, is joy. So joy is delight and a sense of satisfaction that arises by being interested in the object. Okay. So, is this any old object? No. It's got to be an object that hopefully is a Dharma object. Yeah. And definitely an object that you want to develop serenity on. Yeah. So joy, you know, we usually think of joy as it's a kind of happiness. You're exuberant with happiness. Okay. Is an exuberant mind going to work really well if you're developing concentration? No, the mind is too hyped up. It's too excited, yeah? So this kind of joy, it's delight and a sense of satisfaction, yeah? But it's not like, oh, goody, you know? And I really want, you know, we really need to keep this in mind, because when we hear be happy, what do we think of? Yeah? Oh, everything's going to go the way I want it to go. Yeah. Oh, tomorrow we're going to have this. Good. And tomorrow's my birthday, and everybody's going to sing happy birthday. Yeah. And, you know, and I'm going to get that promotion. And then we're going to go see Melania at the... Well, some people, that's exciting. but, you know... That's what we think of as happiness, but that's not what we're trying to develop in meditation, you know, especially where we're trying to keep our mind on a particular object, okay? So I think with serenity, what one of the learning things that we have to do is, what does it feel like to feel peaceful? What does it feel like to accept things? What does it feel to have a sense of delight without clinging on? What does it feel like to be satisfied with something? How often are we ever satisfied? Yeah? So, you know, there's all these kind of new mental factors that we don't have much practice in. New emotions, yeah, that we're going to have to, you know, generate and then get used to. Yeah, because we want excitement. We want action, you know. Even if we don't like what's happening, something's happening, you know. Well... There's one book, one of my friends wrote it. Usually, you know, the slogan is, don't just sit there, do something. So she wrote a book about meditation. Don't just do something, sit there. Yeah. Can we sit there? Yeah? Can we sit there? Or do we get, you know, heebie-jeebies? Yeah, Spilkies. Yeah, Spilkies are Jewish heebie-jeebies. Okay. You can't sit still. Yeah, you get the heebie-jeebies. What else do we call them?
Antsy.
Oh, yeah. Somebody has ants in their pants. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so joy is delight and a sense of satisfaction that arises by being interested in the object. It arises when the mind settles down and becomes peaceful as a result of investigation and analysis. For example, by recollecting the Buddha with deep concentration, we feel deep inspiration and elation. Not excitement, but a different kind of elation or joy or inspiration or, you know, some positive feeling when we think about the qualities of a Buddha. So joy brings lightness of body and mind. Sometimes it may even feel like the body is floating in air. Eat more potatoes. You'll come down to earth. Okay. Joy is the result of having developed some degree of concentration. So it's a type of happiness that comes from being able to focus the mind and be interested in it. Bliss, the fourth of the absorption factors. Bliss is the pleasant and happy feeling that accompanies concentration as a result of the peacefulness and stillness of the mind. This bliss is unlike what we usually call bliss in a worldly sense, because now the mind is tranquil and satisfied. Okay. Now, when do we usually use the word bliss? Yeah. When you just had the best high you could ever get, huh? Yeah, from drugs, from sex, from music, whatever it is, I'm blissful. Yeah. Meaning, I don't want this feeling to end. Is that feeling going to end? Of course. Yeah. And are the things that we do to get blissful, are they actually blissful? Yeah. When you think, okay, you want to drink and drug, is the process of you know, getting the alcohol, getting the dope, rolling the dope, smoking the joint, splitting up the pills with your friends, whatever you're doing, you know, and then snorting, you know, does snorting make you happy? You know, inhaling smoke, yeah, drinking alcohol, ugh. Some of you go, yeah, I like that one. But, you know, just think of what we consider blissful. Yeah. We think of sex as blissful. Is sex really blissful? Yeah. If you look at the feeling that you have when your body is really aroused, is that peaceful? Is that blissful? It's completely filled with this outrageous craving and grasping of, I want more, I want more. This is, and you get yourself so pumped up that, I mean, there's no peace in the mind or in the body. But we call that bliss. But think about it. You know, think about some of the things that we usually call blissful. I got a promotion. How is that blissful? Yeah, like I said, then you have the great bliss of working 12-hour days, you know. Okay, so just think about, you know, what you usually consider blissful. Yeah. This bliss is unlike what we usually call bliss in a worldly sense, because now the mind is tranquil and satisfied. So joy is likened to a delight, to the delight a thirsty traveler has upon seeing an oasis. So they're joyful. It's like, oh, there's water. They don't have it yet, but they can look forward to the water. So they feel happy. Yeah. But bliss is likened to the happiness and pleasure he experiences by drinking the water and resting under a tree. So after you've drunk the water and you rest, your mind isn't, you know, oh, I'm going to get water. Hurry, I got to get it quick. It's going to really satisfy my thirst because I can't stand being so thirsty. No, the bliss, you know, that might be something, you know, like joy, what in a worldly sense. But what we're talking about here is something different. Yeah. I think that last analogy good. Thirsty delight. Joy is likened to the delight a thirsty traveler has upon seeing an oasis. Okay, so if you imagine that, yeah, you'd be happy. Yeah. And bliss is likened to the happiness and pleasure he experiences by drinking the water and then resting under a tree. That's different, isn't it? Yeah. Okay. Then one-pointedness, the last absorption factor. One-pointedness unifies the mind and its accompanying mental factors on the object. It is a stillness of the mind that allows the mind to stay in a relaxed manner on the meditation object. Yeah, allows the mind to stay in a relaxed manner on the meditation object. How often during the day are we thinking about something in a relaxed manner? Yeah. It's like 25 past 5 in the morning, and I just woke up, and I got to get to meditation. Quick, how am I going to do it? Yeah, that's not relaxed. Yeah. Then breakfast. Oh, finally, I get to eat breakfast. Oh, it's the same old stuff. Or, you know, just how our mind usually works. How relaxed are we? When we get into bed at night, are we relaxed? Or are we going over everything in the day? Oh, you know, this happened and that happened. Then this person said this and they did that and I don't like that. No. You know, are we even relaxed when we lay down to sleep? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, why aren't we relaxed? Why is the mind churning? Churning. What do I have to do tomorrow? I have to do this, I have to do that, I have to do the other thing. Yeah. Then you think, but I ordained because I thought that all you do as a monastic is you just look at your belly button all day and pray. Yeah. Well, it's not exactly like that, you know. And then you hear about thought training things to imagine, you know, when you're cleaning the dishes, that you're washing the, you know, all sentient beings' minds, you know, freeing them from the afflictions and the negative karma and so on. Yeah. Are you relaxed washing the dishes? No, I've got to wash quickly, and more quickly, like it says in that prayer. Quickly, and more quickly. Except that one's from supposed to chain awakening. But no, I want to get done with the dishes. Quickly, and more quickly. Yeah. Yeah, Interesting, isn't it? You know? And who makes us such, what's the word? So, it starts with an A. What?
Agitated?
Agitated and anxious. Yeah, see, we can't think of what we are most of the time. We're very often agitated, we're anxious. You know, am I doing this right? I'm sitting down to meditate. Okay, yeah, what's the first step? Oh, I got to take refuge. What's refuge? What's refuge? Oh, yeah, I got to say I believe. And I got to say it. But, you know, there's other people in this community. The refuge is stronger than mine. I'm really not doing well on generating refuge. I have so many doubts. What am I going to do with my doubts? I'm never going to, you know, be able to be a good monastic. I have so many doubts. Do you ever feel like that? Yeah? I was kind of like that for a while. Yeah? You compare yourself to everybody else. Like, I'm never going to make it. I've got to work harder. I've got to do more. Yeah? 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 Yeah. She just sent me the third part of Venerable Benyan's, his whole huge thing of that's going to be more than 400 pages. And, you know, the second one still isn't done. But she's won many, many parts. She has it all laid out. We're going to do this year and this next year and this next year and this next year. And it should be, we should be able to have, here's, the, you know, somebody's going to check this and do that and do that and do that. And it's all going to be done. We're going to publish it by 2030 when I'm 80 years old. That's going to be my 80-year-old birthday present. Thank you so much. What?
Then I got anxious about dying.
Yeah.
After I wrote that.
Yeah. Yeah, we might die. And then somebody else is going to have to take over. Who's going to take over it? We better appoint them now. They better get going. But she has this whole schedule, which is ridiculous because I'm going through reading this, and a lot of what he says doesn't, well, not a lot, but some things, it doesn't make sense. It's contradictory. There's a whole paragraph, and it's things contradictory. And she told me somebody went through and checked that. Huh? Yeah. So, yeah, please, get anxious. Yeah. Yeah. Because I regret to inform you that I'm not going to be able to. I'm going to do things at my own pace. When I can. I have a few other things, you know, writing projects online, yeah, that I have to take care of too. And how am I going to get them all done before I die? Oh, what happens if I die first? Then I leave it here. I'm going to be on my deathbed and say, who wants to finish Venerable Benyan's thing? Who wants to finish the book? No, start the book on Amitabha. I didn't get around to that. Come on. I can't die yet. Yeah, maybe we need to learn how to relax, huh? Yeah. Yeah. And what gets done. And what doesn't get done. Somebody else will do it later. Ooh. Okay. Why don't they make robes that stick on. Why? Yeah. I mean, Chinese robes. Well, no, the hook breaks. Vietnamese robes. I would be so much more relaxed if we wore a Vietnamese chugu that you could tie. You know? It has two things and you tie. And it doesn't fall off your shoulders. And there's no hook that breaks.
You just need some football shoulder pads to make your shoulders really square and big.
Oh, okay. Now, since you mentioned that, I'm sure we're going to get 22 pairs of shoulder pads. Yeah, except some of you can keep your chugus on. You know, maybe I'm the only one. Okay. So as we approach dhyana, the five factors... sequentially increase in strength. Yeah. I listen to some people, you know, how people have different cadences when they teach. Some are just so refined and calm. When all five are present and work together to plunge the mind into the meditation object so that the mind becomes completely absorbed in the object, the first dhyana is attained. Yeah, will you stay awake if I talk like that? I don't think so. But some people, you know, the way they teach, so calm. So.
Theravada.
Yeah, Theravada, yeah. There's a certain, you know, way that you teach. Yeah. And I don't represent the Tibetan tradition. Not everybody in the Tibetan tradition is as nutty as I am. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So should I read that sentence again? Or did you fall asleep during it? Okay. So as we approach dhyana, the five factors sequentially increase in strength. So they come in sequence. Yeah, it's not like you get one-pointedness first and then, you know, you get the other things. There's a sequence. When all five are present and work together to plunge the mind into the meditation object so that the mind becomes completely absorbed in the object, the first dhyana is attained. So you're completely absorbed, yeah. You don't care about what time it is or what's for lunch, yeah. Or if you said the right thing when you, in the conversation you had when you were supposed to be silent. Okay. So investigation and analysis are the basic application of mind that leads to samadhi. So those are the ones you emphasize at the beginning, yeah, especially because they're the first two in the sequence. While they investigate and examine the object respectfully, they do not judge or form opinions about it. Oh, huh. You're just examining the object without forming opinions. How often were we taught to do that in school? No, you're supposed to read something and have an opinion, you know, about what you read or what you think. And, you know, it starts when you're really young. You're 3 years old and mommy says, what kind of juice, what do you want to drink? You know, and then you have to have, you know, what's your favorite drink? You have to have a favorite drink. Yeah, have an opinion about that. And what's your favorite color? Yeah, yeah. That's how you know that you're graduating to kindergarten, is that now you're asked what your favorite color is. So you have to have an opinion. What's your favorite color? Yeah? And we're taught to do that. So it's hard to focus on the object, be interested in it, but without the mind making, you know, ruminating about it. Yeah. How do you do that? No, what's your question?
Well, maybe it's that, but I don't think it is. I guess maybe I'm interpreting it too broadly to say, you know, to not judge or form opinions about it, that can also be positive. So imagining meditating on the Buddha and getting to that inspiration, that joy that we discussed earlier.
Yeah, but that's going to just come from focusing on the image of the Buddha and what you know about the Buddha's qualities from before. Yeah.
Okay.
So instead, investigation and analysis come to know the object well and maintain interest in it. So you have interest, but you're not forming judgments and opinions. Yeah. Like, you know, medicine Buddha is blue. But the Tonka, I don't like that shade blue that's in the Tonka. Yeah. Can I make it a different shade of blue? Yeah. Oh, no, can I? You know, and then you get involved in, you don't like that shade of blue. Okay. Investigation is initially more prominent because it applies the mind to the object repeatedly. Once the object is fixed in the mind with mindfulness, analysis continues the awareness and examination of the object. For example, investigation applies the mind to the meditation object, which at this stage is the counterpart sign. So maybe you have a visualized image of the Buddha in your mind, for example. And analysis sustains that awareness and examines and knows the counterpart sign. Yeah. These are the two basic and most important functions that develop samadhi. Okay? So you have to, it sounds like you also have to recognize that it's a conceived object, you know, the counterpart sign is the conceived object, yeah, that it's not a statue that you're visualizing, yeah. And it's not a real Buddha, so if your visualization starts talking to you, yeah, maybe say, what? Okay, joy and bliss arise when investigation and analysis harmonize and work together and become more refined. Yeah. So it's like the mental factors have to come together and work together. Yeah. Not contradict each other. Okay. So, for example, investigation applies the mind to the meditation object, which at this part is the counterpart sign, and analysis sustains that awareness and examines and knows the counterpart sign. These are the two basic and most important functions that develop samadhi. Yeah. So we shouldn't neglect them and skip over them. Joy and bliss arise when investigation and analysis harmonize and work together and become more refined. Okay. As concentration increases, joy arises. Having elements of exuberance and elation, joy is relatively coarse compared with bliss, which is the feeling of pleasure that accompanies concentration. Okay, Although joy is exhilarating, bliss is more relaxed and satisfying. Okay, so joy does have this element of, kind of this is good, and I like this feeling, the exuberance and elation. So that comes naturally, in the first dhyana. As we go towards the second dhyana, we're going to leave the joy behind because it is too much to deepen the concentration. It interferes with deepening the concentration. Okay. So these five factors have to be cultivated with patience. Yeah. So do something with your schedule. Yeah. Well, I'm going to attain samadhi by this and such a date. We cannot will access concentration or any other meditative state to arise. Can you will yourself to just keep your mind on the object? Yeah. You try to will yourself, I'm going to do it. My mind's on the object. And then before you know it, your mind's on something else. And how did that happen? Yeah. So this being patient with ourselves and in the process, is really important. Making meditation into a struggle is not the way to attain blissful samadhi. Okay, I'm sitting down. I'm really going to concentrate. I'm not going to get distracted. And then our mind's like that. Not going to work. Okay. So making meditation into a struggle is not the way to attain blissful samadhi. And pushing makes the mind tight and agitated, producing the opposite of what we wish. But we're so used to pushing ourselves, aren't we? More and better, more and better. Let's just get this done. Yeah. But it makes the mind tight and agitated, which is not the mental state that's going to lead to concentration. It is more effective to soften the mind and allow concentration to deepen. If we cultivate the factors with consistent but relaxed effort, when they are mature and strong, the mind will go into full absorption by itself. Yeah. So this is where equanimity is so important, It's like, I will accept it, whether I'm getting better or it doesn't seem to get better, because it's I'm not trying to get an A+ and, pass the advanced placement exams so that I can graduate college at 11 years old. Yeah, we're not doing that. We just do our practice in a relaxed way. While the five factors may sometimes be present in ordinary consciousnesses, they do not work together. When cultivating samadhi, they work together to reduce and finally suppress the hindrances. Although each factor has more sway in counteracting one or another of the hindrances. Okay, so investigation, what it chiefly counteracts is lethargy and sleepiness by putting the mind on the meditation object. Analysis counteracts doubt by keeping the mind steady on the object without the jumpiness of doubt. And saying, what if I did this? What if I did that? Joy counteracts malice. So you're not getting mad at yourself or at somebody else. And bliss is the remedy to restlessness and regret, because the mind naturally prefers what is delightful over what is agitating. So you don't have to make your mind feel blissful. Yeah. I always got stuck on this, you know, when Lama Zopa would often lead tantric meditations, you know, feel, and he would say, feel great bliss. I'm going, what is that? Yeah, the deity absorbed into you, feel great bliss. What is great bliss feel like? You know, and then I'd sit and like try and figure that out. But I don't know. Does anybody else have that problem? Yeah? Somebody tells you, feel great bliss? No. All I know is, yippee! No, that's not it. Yeah? Okay. I was talking with one of my friends who's done several years of retreat, you know, and asked him how he thinks of great bliss. And he said, what was the particular word he used? It was like contentment. Yeah. Satisfaction with what is. Yeah. He used another word, which is slipping my mind. But that's the meaning, you know. Great bliss isn't, oh, yippee. It's, you know, a quiet sense of fulfillment. That's the word he used. Fulfillment. Yeah. Usually when you think of feeling fulfilled, yeah, you don't think of, oh, yippee. Yeah. It's a different kind of feeling, yeah. Okay. So, and then when pointedness works against sensual desire by unifying the mind on the object in a worthwhile way. Okay. So you can see that these five factors are so much the opposite of the five hindrances. Yeah. And I think, you know, this is why getting a good grounding in Lam Rim and Lojung, you know, so that when you have your mind is upset, your mind is distracted, your mind is full of lust, your mind is like wanting chocolate cake, your mind is, you know, whatever is, that you have an antidote, that you know how to handle that state of mind. Because when you're developing concentration, you know, all of our old thoughts and habit patterns are going to come up, and we need to know how to deal with them. Alan Wallace, you know, I don't know if he's doing this now or if he's shifted direction a little bit, but he used to have a lot of students that were doing retreat to develop, you know, serenity. And one of the women who was doing that, she was here with us for a while, and we bumped into her at some place with His Holiness or some big Dharma event. And we were asking, you know, well, how's it going? And, you know, she said, just everything comes up. You know, your problems come up, your dreams, your dissatisfaction. Yeah, I had another friend who did long retreat. She said, all the commercial jingles that you heard as a child, you know, they come up, you know, your mind gets quiet. What, you know, you got to get some excitement. So, yeah, what jingle are they going to do? Huh? Or you have the commercial, all videoed in your mind, you know, especially, oh, you know, like the ones about, what is it, ring around the toilet? Do you remember that one?
Oh, yeah.
Or was it ring around the collar?
Ring around the collar.
But I think there was also one that was ring around the toilet. You know, because if you have a ring around the toilet or a ring around your husband's collar, your marriage is off. Yeah. You're never going to stay married. Yeah. So this is what we grew up with, you know, and this is what's going to come in your mind. Yeah. And then how about Dennis the Menace? Yeah. Yeah. Are you going to have reruns of Dennis the Menace?
Leave it to Beaver.
Leave it to Beaver. Okay. Yeah. Or Lassie. Or Father Knows Best. Or, yeah.
Sky King.
What?
Sky King.
Sky King. Yeah, Saturday morning.
No, I watched cowboy and Indian movies on Saturday morning. That's what my brother wanted, and I had to.
My friend Flicka?
Uh-huh.
The horse
No. This is a few years difference, you know. You remember. Okay. But these things can come up in your mind, you know. You're sitting there doing your meditation, and then, whew, so you need to know how to deal with those things. Otherwise, if you know, and that's why we need to get very, very well versed in the antidotes to the various afflictions. Otherwise, you know, you're going to be remembering that program, you know, that one episode of Lassie. Yeah, everybody agree on Lassie? Yeah, that one episode of Lassie, and you're going to be playing it over and over and over again in your mind. Yeah. Oh, here, this is very cute. What one person did. Okay. So I heard a story about one Theravada monk, and he was meditating in Thailand, and I guess it was at New Year's or sometimes when it was a big festival. No, it was at Christmas. And it was at one of the, you know, places where a lot of tourists go. So all the tourist events were on one side of the lake or the river, and he was meditating on the other, but they had the loudspeaker on, you know, and they kept playing Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Yeah, over and over, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. What else? Come on. He knows,
and if you ever saw him,
but even now it glows.
Yeah.
And then all the other reindeer. Yes.
Used to laugh and call him names. They never let poor Rudolph join in any reindeer games. Then on foggy Christmas Eve, Santa came to say, Rudolph, with your nose so bright, won't you guide the sleigh tonight? The reindeer loved him, and they shouted with glee,
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, you are now in history. I'm crying. No, it makes me laugh so hard. No, I didn't know all the lyrics, you know, because I didn't, yeah. But I could figure out what's going to rhyme when you said it. Okay, so they kept playing Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer at the big holiday thing again and again. And here's this monk trying to meditate on the other side of the water, you know. And You know, and this is going around and around. They're playing it, and it's going around and around in his head. You know, when you can't get a melody out of your head. Like tonight, when all of you start singing Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Namo Ami, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Yeah. So he was just getting so frustrated and so upset because it was really interfering with his retreat and he wanted to meditate. And then, he started to listen more closely to the lyrics. And when he listened to the lyrics and thought about them, he said, wow, you know, this is a meditation about love and compassion, including other people, not doing things that hurt their feelings, you know. And then he just had the rest of his meditation on love and compassion, you know, because he let this is when I think of poor Rudolph. You know, and all of his friends, they wouldn't let him play in any reindeer games. You know, it's like you remember being a kid when somebody wouldn't let you play in their games. Yeah. And then, you know, now you're an adult. Wow, poor Rudolph, I have compassion. And, you know, how about all the compassion for all the people I usually don't have compassion for? The people I compete with, the people I'm jealous of, you know. And so that's what he did. He used the lyrics to deal with the affliction, which I thought was quite clever. Yeah. So this is also, you know, when you're trying to focus in your meditation and you get distracted, we have to know the antidotes of what to think of instead of going over and over and over again, you know, with the judge and the prosecutor and convicting that person or our dissatisfaction with whatever, you know. We have to know how to be a doctor to our own mind. Mm-hmm. Or as Lama Yeshe wrote in his, he has a book, Becoming Your Own Therapist. Okay. A mind with full concentration is like a room with only one chair. When the chair is occupied, if another guest comes in, he leaves immediately because there is no place for him to sit. Okay. Similarly, when samadhi is focused one pointedly on the meditation object, other thoughts cannot stay in the mind. As wonderful as concentration is, that's one idea, it's like a room with one chair, Usually what happens, you're in the chair and then another thought comes in and what happens? Then that one's in the chair, that person's in the chair, okay? So to really think, you know, there's only one object. This is when you're developing samadhi, okay? When you're doing Lam Rim meditation, you're switching objects because you're joining different ideas together to really come to a conclusion, yeah? And when you're applying antidotes, you're very often, too, you know, thinking about something, yeah? Okay, then as wonderful as concentration is, it only suppresses the hindrances. It does not eradicate them. Only the wisdom developed by unifying serenity and insight can do that. The mind endowed with mindfulness, introspective awareness, and samadhi gives rise to true wisdom that knows all conditioned phenomena as impermanent, dukkha, and selfless, and that leads to the path wisdom that knows nirvana. Okay, so you know, these meditation states, the dhyanas and so forth, they're great, but alone they do not get us to nirvana, let alone to Buddhahood. Yeah. And so the wisdom element is so important. Yeah. So that's why even we may not understand the teachings on emptiness so well, we should listen to them. We should take notes, review our notes, ask questions, you know, just as a way of building up some familiarity and seeing, you know, what our questions and doubts are. Yeah. Because if we just say, okay, it's all too advanced for me, all I'm going to do is just this, then maybe you'll at some point develop dhyana, but then you won't know anything about wisdom, and you'll go, oh, what do I do now? Yeah, okay. So that's why at our stage, you know, instead of specializing in something, I think it's good that we get really a good, solid foundation with it. All the different meditations, as much as we can. Yes?
Well, I've been wondering what the unity of serenity and insight looks like if you're trying to get your serenity on this object, something like love, which I'm still not sure if it's a feeling or the nimitta arises and it's that or what. I'm curious, but then you stay on your object, you stay on your object, you stay on your object, you stay on your object. At what point then does it become, now you need to move to emptiness, and you better sure well have been meditating on emptiness all this time, or just it's going to happen just like you just said.
Yeah. You have, when, you know, because you're developing everything, a little bit of everything. You know, when you get to the point where you're just going to work to get serenity, then you do a retreat just on serenity. During that retreat, you try not to do too much analysis, okay? Does that mean you don't do any analysis? You know, I think when you're doing your motivation for to do your serenity meditation, yeah, you have some analysis there. So you weave other topics in there, but you don't make them the focus, you know. But then afterwards, you know, then you can start joining the serenity and insight, which comes later, you know, how to do that, okay? And also everybody's different, because some people develop a conceptual realization of emptiness before they generate serenity. Other people attain serenity before they get, you know, the conceptual realization of emptiness. And, you know, before the conceptual realization of emptiness, what about the realization of renunciation? Yeah. So, yeah. There's a lot of things to do. You won't get, if you practice Dharma, you will not get bored. Okay, now the next section is called the Four Dhyanas. So once the five hindrances are suppressed by the five absorption factors, full meditative absorption is attained. There are eight levels of absorption, four from the form realm and four from the formless realm, that a meditator in the human realm can attain. But remember, the human being, their body is going to stay in the human realm. Their mind can go into the form realm or the formless realm. Okay. In each successive state of absorption, concentration deepens. However, the formless absorptions are not useful for gaining realizations because the mind is too absorbed. Yeah. Does that mean that you never are going to get the work to get those? If you want to attain Buddhahood, yes, you have to generate those. Yeah. But that may not be your priority at certain times in your practice. In the Pali Sutras, the Buddha describes right concentration in terms of the four dhyanas that are form realms, spheres of consciousness. So that's, you know, like your body is the human realm, your mind is in the form realm, sphere of consciousness. So here's what the Buddha says. What is right concentration? Herein, secluded from sense pleasures, secluded from non-virtuous states, a monastic enters and dwells in the first dhyana, which is accompanied by investigation and analysis with joy and bliss born of seclusion. Okay, so secluded from sense pleasures, secluded from non-virtuous states. Okay, so yes, you may need a quieter place to meditate, some kind of physical seclusion, but you can have lots of physical seclusion, but your mind's going bonkers and bouncing all over the place. So here it's, you know, having a mind that's secluded from sense pleasure. So you're not always thinking about some kind of sense pleasure. Is that easy or difficult? Secluded from non-virtuous states. We don't have, you know, thoughts come up about wanting to retaliate or wanting to finagle things so we can get what we want or, yeah. Okay. So herein, secluded from sense pleasure, secluded from non-virtuous states. So this is right concentration. A monastic enters and dwells in the first dhyana, which is accompanied by investigation and analysis with joy and bliss born of seclusion. Why does the Buddha say a monastic enters and dwells in the first dhyana? Yeah, can't lay people generate that realization too? Yes, they can. Yeah. If you have a job and a family and so on, it's going to be a little bit harder. Okay. But also, that's not just the thing of distraction. It's when you keep good ethical conduct involves developing our mindfulness and our introspective alertness. Yeah, to develop concentration also depends on developing mindfulness and introspective awareness. Okay, it's the same mental factors used in slightly different ways. But, you know, if we to develop them in concentration, if we have a good basis in keeping good ethical conduct and keeping our precepts well, then that's really going to facilitate gaining concentration. That's why the three higher trainings, ethical conduct, concentration, wisdom, they come in that order, because what you develop on the initial ones will help you develop the next one and will help you develop the one after that. Yeah. You know, so, you know, when we get all excited about the Dharma, yeah, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to realize emptiness. Yeah, and you can't concentrate, and you have no renunciation, your mind's always thinking about sense objects. And so, yeah, okay, lots of attachment to cookies. Okay, is the cookie the flour? Is the cookie the butter? You know, is the cookie the assembly of ingredients? I want to eat a cookie. You know, that's the conclusion of your meditation. Yeah. So, you know, we have to, you know, have much less attachment to sense objects. Yeah. And again, much more equanimity about do we get what we want or not. Yeah. What happens when we don't get what we want? Yeah. Just look at how we react to lunch every day. Yeah. Oh, there's not enough salt. I need to add salt. What about if you didn't add salt? Can you be content without adding the salt? Yeah. Yesterday when we had French fries, I asked Venerable Soltram, can we take out the ketchup to have with the French fries? And she said, no, because it has onion and garlic powder in it. I didn't get what I want. Yeah. But it's a very good practice. Yeah. Because I practice usually not, you know, I might think that the dish needs something else, and I really try to practice not asking for it and not going, even if it's out, not taking it, just being content with the way the food is. Yeah. We got to practice with small things. Okay. With the subsiding of investigation, he enters and dwells in the second dhyana, which has inner confidence and mental unification, is without investigation and analysis, and has joy and bliss born of concentration. Okay. So with the subsiding of investigation, you enter and dwell in the second dhyana, yeah, which has inner confidence that you can meditate, mental unification, your all the different mental factors are there on the object. You're not having investigation and analysis because your mind can probably go into the object deeper when you're not having those two. And it still has joy and bliss born of concentration. Okay. But then, next, with the fading out of joy, he dwells in equanimity, and with mindfulness and introspective awareness, he experiences bliss with the body. He enters and dwells in the third dhyana, of which the Aryas declare, he is equanimous, mindful, one who dwells happily. Okay. So here, really pointing out, equanimity is, yeah, what brings here the bliss of the body and a mind, you know, a willingness to do the meditation and be happy. Yeah, the mind abides with equanimity, mindful, one who dwells happily. Okay, then, yeah, that's going into the third dhyana. Then, yeah, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous disappearance of joy and displeasure, he enters and dwells in the fourth dhyana, which is neither painful nor pleasant, and includes the purification of mindfulness by equanimity. This is called right concentration. So to get the fourth dhyana, yeah, regular, what we call pleasure and pain is, you know, going to be going away. Yeah. And the previous disappearance of joy and displeasure. So, you know, I like, I don't like, I feel good, I don't feel good. All of that has disappeared. And then dwelling in the fourth dhyana, which is neither painful nor pleasant. Yeah, so we think, oh, not painful, not pleasant, boring. Yeah, no, but this is a different kind of feeling, yeah, that seems to be quite different than what we get in the desire realm. which is neither painful nor pleasant and includes the purification of mindfulness by equanimity. This is called right concentration. Okay, I'm just going to read the next bit. The dhyanas are distinguished by their component factors, as shown in the chart below. While the presentation in the sutras and the Abhidharma analysis may differ superficially, they come to the same point. Okay, so you can, I think, study this chart yourself. Yeah, you have the first, second, third, fourth dhyana, and then what the Abhidharma says about it and what the sutra says about it. Yeah, what's there, what's absent. Okay, they start out pretty similar, yeah. But then, you know, there's other things that come in. So just take a look at that, yeah. Okay, questions, comments?
Mm-hmm. We're also studying concentration or serenity in the Thursday morning class. Mm-hmm. And Venerable Khadro brought up that in the Pali tradition, there's not a presentation of the nine mental stages. You know, I don't know if that's the correct.
The nine sustained attentions.
Yeah. And so going through what we've gone through, it sounds like there's this emphasis on the overcoming the five hindrances, developing these five absorption factors, mm-hmm. But it doesn't seem to have, at least here, it's not presented that there are the markers for people to know where they are along the
path. That's okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Markers are for people who like it to be organized. And so we know what's going on at every point. Yeah. But I think you go through exactly the same kind of things. Yeah, to go from first dhyana to second dhyana and so forth. Because a lot, you know, some of what we study comes from the sutras, some of what we study comes from commentaries. Yeah, so I think, you know, there's Maitreya, a lot of the way we learn about concentration comes from Maitreya, okay? So, and they didn't, you know, they don't have those scriptures. So, you know, there might be a deeper Abhidharma analysis. Yeah, I didn't study the Abhidharma according to the Theravada, you know, the Pali tradition. So, but they may have that in there, but it doesn't really matter, you know. They have the divisions of the four dhyanas, and they tell you what you need to develop and what you need to abandon, and that's the same for everybody. Yeah, so you might actually feel relieved. There's not nine stages where you have to memorize what happens on each stage, and then you're constantly checking, what stage am I at? Oh, I got to four this meditation session. Oh, now this one, I'm back at one. You know, maybe sometimes it's better not to have some of the markers. Yeah. Okay, anything else? Yeah.
I'm going to risk sounding really stupid, but anyway, it is a question that I have. With an ordinary mind, I think it's true that I'm probably not knowing even what satisfaction is, or even what fulfillment is. And so, if the mind doesn't know that, would you even recognize it when it came up? Or how do you get to know it?
Yeah, I think, you know, when you have these different experiences, yeah, then the feeling tone, the experience of the mind changes. And so you would have a different experience. And then maybe at that time you would go, oh, maybe this is what they mean by satisfaction.
It says one pointedness unifies the mind and its accompanying mental factors on the object. Well, my grounding in the mental factors is not so strong, I think, but I thought that the accompanying mental factors...
What about what?
The mental factors.
Yeah.
So I thought that the mental factors that accompany the main mind are always on the share the same object.
Yeah, they always share the same object. They're concomitant. But are they really, how to say, you know how you can be there but not really be there? Yeah, like you're kind of semi-concentrating. Something like that, yeah. So it might be, you know, all those mental factors need to really come together on the object instead of, oh, okay, this moment I have this one, this one's prominent. Oh, next moment that one's prominent. Then you're going back and forth. That's my guess. I'm not speaking from experience.
Yeah, I see. And the mental factors meant here that are the five dhyana factors?
Yeah.
And the object, the omnipresent factors and the...
Yeah, you would have the five omnipresent ones.
And the object ascertaining factors.
Which?
The object ascertaining factors.
You would have some of those too. Yeah. You know, you would have belief, you would have aspiration. Would they all be prominent in your manifest in your mind at the same time? Maybe not, but maybe at the beginning of the session, you know, you generate more belief, the one of belief and aspiration and so on. So, you know, and all the mental factors, it isn't like you have them or you don't. They can be stronger and weaker. For example, you know, one pointedness is one of the object ascertaining ones. Well, you know, when you start off, that one's pretty weak, but you develop it. Okay, anything else? Okay. Then we'll dedicate if nobody has anything. Okay, but look at that table a bit more. And then next time we'll start going into more depth about each dhyana. So remember with all of this, you know, it's descriptions. And with descriptions, we're dealing with concept. Yeah? And the concept and the experience are different. Yeah. So right now we're trying to get some idea of what's going on. Yeah. And then as we practice, then, you know, some experience comes. It's got to come. Yeah. If you practice. If you don't practice because you're too anxious, or you have too many things to edit because there's a due date of you got to finish them before you turn 80. Then.
Are you serious about this?
Huh?
It's been laid out like that.
Yes. I'll send it to you.
The relaxed version of the timeline.
What'd you say?
That's the relaxed version of the timeline.
Yeah. Yeah. This is somebody who's a Raffles Girls School graduate, you know, and vice president of the
High Achievers
Neurotic Society. Yeah, she wants to be president.
I'm the secretary.
You're the secretary. Well, you want to be the vice president and the president. So she's just trying to, that's why she did it. She wants me to die of overwork. Okay.